Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew, and we're coming to you live from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains. This is where the past meets the future. The results in here are always positive, whether you're driving across the country tonight or working on your favorite project. Oh, you're going to learn more about what it means, where we came from, why we're here, what we're going to become, what the potential of all potentialities might be for you. Our AccuWindow forecast is about 83 degrees and just about that humid as well. It just finished a nice thunderstorm. Tonight, in the first hour, we have Charles Green coming on. You'll remember he hosted a show called ET Yoga. Very interesting insights and even revelations that this young man had after he became a student of several yogis out there. We'll talk about that at the bottom of the hour. We also have some great updates in the news. There are some amazing things going on, amazing things. The solar wind is a brisk 465 kilometers per second, been up all week long. There are only three sunspot clusters on the sun today. The most alarming thing about the space news today is that the Earth's best early warning system for near-Earth objects has been shut down due to lack of funds. Really? Yes, really. Sequester has been blamed for leaving the Earth wide open to a meteor strike with almost no warning. The U.S. Air Force Space Surveillance Radar, or Space Fence, has stopped transmitting. It appears they pulled the plug at 0 degrees, at 6 a.m. Local MDT. And that's reported by engineer Stan Nelson, who has been monitoring the radar using an antenna in Roswell, New Mexico. The shutdown is a result of what you have heard about in the news, this sequester. It is a bluff, actually, that was put up, actually agreed to by the Republicans with the Democrats. The Democrats had a budget idea. The Republicans said, well, we will come up with a budget idea or die. And the Democrats said, well, how about if we just make a little wager? If you don't come up with a budget that I can accept, we will cut a fixed percentage across the board, all government programs. And the Republicans agreed. And the remarkable thing is that sequester kicked in because Mr. Obama wouldn't sign anything that the Republicans came up with. And so this fail-safe kicked in and started slashing budgets, a fixed amount across the board, all programs, even the military, even NASA. And the nice thing is that the tax revenues continued on, and the forced cuts actually made it to where we're pretty close to a balanced budget. We would be if it wasn't for all these unbelievable spending programs, not the least of which is just printing $85 billion a month and slamming it into the bond market to shore up the dollar. We're going to talk about that in the second hour, because not that it's, you know, confusing or that you need to be informed about confusing things, but you need to know what to do with your money. Your money being your savings account, your 401k, your IRA. What do you do with your money? How do you continue to let the mega banks manage your money? And you need to be informed. You need to be aware. You need to be positioned. That's why you listen to X Squared Radio, because you want to know, as this past alchemical design of what seems to be centuries-long preparation to take over the world without firing a shot, or maybe just a few shots over the bow, how it has been working out. generation after generation of greed and lust and power and corruption, it inches forward decade after decade after decade, and now we're sitting at the threshold of this immense takeover. Where do you go? How do you position yourself? Well, you got to hang around to the second hour to find out. Our phone lines will be open the entire 3 hours tonight. 888-429-5471, anywhere in North America for free. How about that? 888-429-5471. And anywhere else on planet or off planet, if you can dial this number, you can reach us. It's 530-413-9537. 530-413-9537. And if you want to listen by cell phone, now you won't be able to talk back to us, although you may be tempted to do so. You can listen. And the quality has really been upgraded by the folks down at BBS Radio in Paradise. No, seriously, they live in Paradise, California. Paradise, California. It is 805-399-1000. 805-399-1000. When you hear the little robot lady, you need to put in the passcode 769-608-POUND, 769-608-POUND, and then you can listen to the program with your cell phone. And if you put that on speed dial, you're one button away from jumping right into X Squared Radio Live. First up tonight, you know that October 10th, we have the Breakthrough Energy Movement Conference. It is in the United States this year, in Boulder, Colorado. Last year it was in Amsterdam, just outside of Amsterdam, a little town called Hilversum, Holland. And if you made that one, you heard the Breakthrough Energy Movement Conference lecture that I made on the Global Energy Freedom Fund and a report that the National Electrical Reliability Corporation had issued on the triumvirate threat against the global grid system. Europe has exactly the same threat. So it's actually a global Western world threat of against a unified grid system. Now, why do you think they would want to do a unified grid system? Oh, well, the economics are pretty easy to understand. If they make excess power in Niagara, they can sell that power through the grid to be used in Phoenix, Arizona, to run those air conditioners because it's a little sunnier, longer out west, and they need more energy to run the air conditioning in those big office buildings. Nobody likes to sweat or be dehydrated while wearing a suit. You know how it is. Well, in order to transfer energy from Niagara Falls through the grid to Phoenix, the frequency has to match exactly. The phase has to match exactly. This requires strict controls, regulation, and coordination. That's what the National Electrical Reliability Corporation does. Yes, they are a corporation, but they are also heavily, heavily federally funded, because it is the lifeblood of everything that runs on electricity, including your entire sub-electronic world. And so in unifying the grid, it has created the opportunity, or shall we say the vulnerability, for a threat. And the threat is threefold, at least according to their report. The first is what they consider to be pandemic. That is a global flu or polio or smallpox or something. If it takes out the important people that know how to do stuff at the power company, they need to be able to have remote command and control, or at least central command and control somewhere in a bunker in the world so that the grid can keep functioning. The second threat is against cyber attack or physical attack. If that occurs, then you need to have some kind of way to unplug that grid and some protocols to be able to keep that grid running while the cyber or physical threat at that local location or global location is being addressed. And the third and final one is what we call a natural disaster. Could be a hurricane, could be a tsunami, could be a solar blast, something like that, that disables a portion of the grid. Then you have to be able to make up power from other generation sources to support that grid. You also have to prevent the damage from ricocheting through the grid to other places. That's what happened a couple of years ago when the little snafu in Yuma, Arizona shut down El Toro Marine Base for 8 hours. Obviously an unacceptable situation. So in conducting that, we made the proposal at the Breakthrough Energy Movement Conference last year that an alternative be proposed. While the NERC was being funded with $200 billion of taxpayer funds to unify and harden this grid against these three threats, which were actually empowered by unifying the grid. So what we did is we proposed what is called a low-voltage local supply. This is advanced technology that can produce the 120 or 240 volts at low amperage, say 2 or 3 or 4 kilowatts instead of the mega megawatts that you see being put out from these big power stations at extremely high voltage, 161,000 to 250,000 to 450,000 volts, run across the country on big aluminum lines and then step down with various transformers, auto tap transformers, that step it down to the voltage at higher amperage that you use at your factories and businesses and homes. The alternative is to create a local low-voltage supply, something that sits on your roof or sits in your yard or sits on your acreage, local to your business or your farm or your neighborhood. Now, some logical opposition questions might come up, like, hey, the power companies are never going to allow you to do that because you'll be cutting into their profits. That's utter nonsense. I can tell you right now, it would not remove one single fraction of a penny of their profits. And you don't even have to sell the power back. The excess power can just be excess power, shunted into the ground or used to, you know, for nothing. Why? Because what you're doing is you're reducing the need of that power company to create more power generation. They don't have to spend another $2 or $3 billion to build another power station. However, the number of homes and businesses and expansion of various towns and cities and megacities is going to require more energy. And so as this energy is being supplied by these local low voltage advanced technologies, the power grid suppliers who are supplying the main more reliable source of power simply raises their rates, so their revenues don't go down at all. They continue to expand their network, but they don't supply as much power as they normally do. Now, I would say it's obvious that these local low-voltage supplies are going to supply less energy than you're used to getting over the grid, which means you probably won't be able to run your air conditioner. You probably won't be able to run your dryer or your stove. But you would be able to run lights. You would be able to run a water pump. You would be able to run what we call essential services. In order to supply enough power for a home to run night and day, you're talking $20,000 to $30,000 investment per unit. That is financially not feasible for about 97% of the country, both commercial and residential. What we need are solutions that run in the $2,000 to $5,000 range and can supply a couple of kilowatts, say 2 kilowatts or 3 kilowatts. It's enough to run a series of lights in your home. It's enough to run a television or a radio. It's enough to run the washing machine, but not the dryer. It's enough to run fans, but not the air conditioner. These are essential services. Yes, it means, you know, a step back to the late 50s as far as what technology you can run and at what power levels you can run. But you're not dark. You're not rubbing two sticks together to make fire here. You can still run a refrigerator, okay? You can still run a freezer. You can still preserve your lifestyle for a week or 2 weeks or a month or 6 months using these local low-voltage supplies. Now, they don't exist yet, not on a large scale, not in an affordable manner. Why is that? Ah, I'm so glad you asked that question. The reason it doesn't exist yet is because all the money in the financial industry is being pumped into nuclear power. Well, you don't believe me? Check it out for yourself. I promise you. 80% of the EPA's grant funds are sent to nuclear power stations. Sorry, that's just the way it is. 80% of the Department of Energy's funds go to nuclear power. That's just the way it is. What we're asking for with the Global Energy Freedom Fund is that 1% of that $200 billion that's going to be spent with a National Electrical Reliability Corporation, that would be $2 billion, be set aside for a nonprofit organization that would be chaired by nine nations, and those funds would be granted to inventors and manufacturers and technology developers to get this advanced technology, which does exist, but it exists in basements and attics and backyard laboratories of great engineers who work for or have worked for electrical engineering firms or electrical engineering contractors. Their companies are not interested in this advanced technology, whether it's resonators or collectors or supercapacitors or solar combination wind combination chemical electricity. They're not interested in that technology. The banks aren't interested in that technology. Investors couldn't care less about that technology. And so we need grant money to be able to get to these inventors so they can build the prototypes and get them ready to go to manufacturing so they can be produced on a cost-effective scale. They can be put in electric vehicles. They can be put in standalone refrigerators. They can be put on rooftops of office buildings and skyscrapers and hospitals and police stations and schools and even homes to provide that essential service as a low voltage alternative. It can be done. Now, so far, there has been no movement on this, obviously, or I wouldn't be speaking to you about it right now. I would be managing that nonprofit. So the NERC is going to continue as business as usual. And they're going to start practicing power grid down drills. The power grid vulnerabilities are finally garnering some attention by government officials because the NERC has done a very, very effective and I think legitimate job of at least presenting the threat that they have facilitated. In organizing and unifying the grid into one giant system that thinks alike and works alike, they've created their own vulnerability. It's sort of like they've gone to Congress and they've said, listen, thank you for all the money. We've really done a good job of unifying the grid, but we've made some discoveries that we're kind of vulnerable, and so we need some more money. An electrical grid joint drill simulation is being planned in the United States, Canada, and Mexico. Thousands upon thousands of utility workers, FBI agents, anti-terrorism experts, governmental agencies, the NERC, and on and on and on, all kinds of letters, and more than 150 private businesses are involved in the November 2013 power grid drill. Now, why November? That's a good question. Because it is considered to be a low demand month. it's going to be the first low demand month. Now, the northern states, it's starting to get a little bit chilly. But most of the United States and Mexico is experiencing a time when you don't have to run those air conditioners. During the day, you can throw the windows open. At night, you don't have to run the air conditioning. It's not humid anymore. It isn't cold, but it isn't warm. It's considered a low demand month. That's why they're doing it in November. The downed power grid simulation will reportedly focus on both physical and cyber attacks. The antiquated electrical system in the United States has been one of the most neglected pieces of integral infrastructure. The EMP, that stands for Electromagnetic Pulse, the EMP Commission, created by Congress, released a report in 2008 calling for increased planning and testing and a stockpiling of needed repair items, namely those auto-tap transformers I told you about. Those are $250,000-plus transformers. There are no spares. If an auto-tap transformer is taken out by an EMP, either solar or nuclear, because that pulse is going to be stepped up by those transformers and put onto the grid, not in the millions of volts, in the hundreds of millions of volts, and it's going to melt the cores down. And when you melt the cores down of the auto-tap transformers, guess what you don't have? You don't have electricity to the factories that make the transformers. Mm-hmm. And so you're down for not 2 years, maybe 5 years. Can you imagine not having access to a smartphone, a laptop, or anything else for 5 years? Yeah, it's a long, long time to be dry. So this new technology is needed desperately, desperately, and yet there is no funds, zero, nothing, not 50 bucks, nation, border to border in Canada, the U.S., or Mexico for this new energy technology. So that means we're going to be leaning on you, the listeners, to start funding some of this technology. Let me go on. The SHIELD Act, which is now stalled in Congress, is the first serious piece of legislation in decades to attempt to address the vulnerabilities of the power grid in the United States, Canada, and Mexico. As previously reported by Off the Grid News, a recent American Society of Civil Engineers report, it gave the power grid a D+ when grading various pieces of infrastructure and public services in the United States. The disaster drill is being described as a crisis practice, unlike anything the real power grid has ever experienced. It's called the Grid EX2 drill. It's going to take place on November 13th and 14th, and it will focus primarily on how governments will react if the electrical grid fails. And, for instance, the food supply chain collapses. Use your imagination, Earth explorers, what the government would do if the food supply chain collapses. American utility companies are responsible for running approximately 5,800 power plants and about 450,000 high-voltage transmission lines, controlled by various devices which have been put in place over the past decades. Some of the utility companies which oversee the power grid reportedly use antique computer protocols, DOS, and even relay technology. It's probably actually safe from cyber hackers. But the modern stuff, the digital stuff, the stuff that's run by, say, Siemens or Johnson Controls, oh, it's vulnerable. The Times said experts call the power grid the nation's glass jaw. Even the military gets 99% of its power the same way every citizen gets it, from commercially run companies. By the way, that's why Vision Motor Cars is the pioneer in vehicle-to-grid systems, to use electric vehicles as a rolling emergency power supply for facilities, especially military facilities. And do you know, to this day, here we are in the September 1st of 2013, to this day, not one single solitary electric truck has been purchased by the government. Not one. And the technology's been here for 3 years. years. The first proposal was made to the Pentagon 2.5 years ago. Oh, they've spent lots of money, tens of millions of dollars a quarter, but it's all consumed internally. They never actually buy any vehicles. So we're standing by. We're standing by. We're ready to deliver at a moment's notice. If an adversary lands a knockout blow, whether it's the sun, the sea, or an actual cyber or physical enemy, it could black out vast areas of the continent for weeks, perhaps months, interrupt supplies of water, gasoline, diesel fuel, and fresh food. It could shut down communications, create disruptions of a scale that was only hinted at by Hurricane Sandy. We're talking about dark, dark times. Imagine not getting another text for 3 years. Can you handle that? Well, that's a really good question. Anyway, I suggest that you make your way to the Breakthrough Energy Movement Conference the weekend of the 10th through the 13th of October. It's within driving distance of you, I promise. Get there. Learn about this new technology. Learn about what you can do to lobby for it in your local communities, your states, and your federal governments. Make phone calls. Send letters. This $2 billion could save us from darkness. All right, we're at the bottom of the hour, and I promised you that we would bring Charles Green on the program. Charles Green, if you've been listening to BBS Radio for a long time, almost as long as X Squared Radio has been on the air, then you know the name Charles Green. He is a student of yoga. Now that's not unusual, but what is unusual is the lengths that Charles went to become a master at this. And I personally like yoga. It would be great if it wasn't for all that stretching. But what happened with Charles is he began to get, let's just call it revelations. He began to make deeper, more expansive connections, because yoga, and he's going to explain this much better than I can, is a method of connecting the body to everything and connecting the soul through the body to everything. And some people make a connection better than others. And when they do, sometimes they go reclusive and they become, you know, a yogi themselves and teach others. And sometimes they become a great student and they use their teaching ability to share with others. And that's what Charles has done. And tonight, I want to take a half hour or an hour and talk about belief systems and answer the question, how do we know? I mean, we study that all the time in philosophy. It is the root good of philosophy. How do you know? So let's bring Charles on and see where we can go with this. Charles, welcome to the program.
Good evening, and my pleasure to be on your show.
Oh, it's a pleasure to have you. You know, I am really serious about yoga. I mean, I love the whole theory and everything. It just can't stretch anymore. I mean, that's all there is to it.
Well, this is kind of the Western take on yoga. And the Western take, because the Western mind was more interested in the physical aspects of yoga, it became what is known and is popular across North America, and thus lots of yoga classes, which are really one small branch of yoga, which it's called Hatha yoga, and it's what they are called asanas. Actually, the word yoga itself means union, and it means union of you and your higher self. And, of course, this was my initial interest in the subject, because years and years ago, my own spiritual experiences led me to the realization that, yes, in point of fact, there were a higher level of consciousness, and that you were able to attain those levels, and thus my interest in seeking out some of the best yoga masters in the world. And my teachers in that regard were Sri Ramana Maharshi, Paramahansa Yogananda, who was quite famous in California, founded Self-Realization Fellowship, and also Sri Swami Satchidananda, who actually had his base on the east coast of the United States. And through many, many years of learning systems about connecting with a higher self, I became quite interested in the connection between extraterrestrial information, let's say, and yoga. And how is that connection made for me? Well, it's made because the extraterrestrial information of certain types, of course, and in specific ways, connects with helping us all to become more of who we are or our true selves, and made some astounding, I mean, for me, just amazing revelations concerning exactly how the world of 3D operates. And well, if you'd like, I'd like to really, you know, expand here a little bit more about that. Back in about late 1980s.
Well, hang on, because you walked through a lot of sidewalks here, across a lot of grass. Let me try to centralize this and widen the road a little bit. You talked about spiritual experiences, which I think, you know, just about everybody can have if they pray or meditate or get in some kind of really, really calm state and expand your mind, which I think yoga can help you do. And I think that most people at some time in their life do have a spiritual experience. However, usually when they, you know, fall backwards in the chair, so to speak, when they have this spiritual experience, there's usually somebody religious there to catch them and say, oh, here's the experience that you had, my son. You need to be a Baptist, Presbyterian, Methodist, Catholic, blah, 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 blah. And you fill it in, and then you fall into their doctrine. You fall into the dogma and ritual of their organization. Now, I think that's the difference between having a religious experience and having a spiritual experience. And one more sidewalk I want to kind of butt up against that one is that, you know, Jesus, we know his youth up until the time he was about 2.5 years old. And then we don't see him again until he's about 14. And then we don't see him again until he's 30. And a lot of historians are now very convinced, including a lot of scholars, shall we call them scriptorians, are convinced that Jesus may have traveled to the east. Just the way you did by visiting these yogis, he went and visited these ancient masters and learned these techniques as well.
Well, to address kind of your comments, the first one relating to spirituality and religion, I know a lot of people have a problem with the idea, how can you believe in God or a prime creator or whatever concept of the infinite that your mind would like to label that concept of spirit without following some religious dogma. And personally, I know there are a lot of people that have an issue with it. They don't quite understand that how you can be spiritual and believe in that and yet not follow, let's say, a specific religion. So with respect to that, yeah, and for me personally, I'm a very spiritual person, but I don't have an interest in particularly in organized religion. Now, with respect to Christ, I'm not a historian, but I do know that with respect to some of his linkages to India in particular, that in Self-Realization Fellowship, when they give their line of spiritual masters, it goes like this. Babaji kind of at the top, then Christ. There's Yogananda, for example, his spiritual teacher or guru was Lahira Mahasaya. And then his guru was, his guru was Sri Yukteswar, whose guru was Lahira Mahasaya, then Babaji, then Christ. So if you walk into this Paramahansa Yogananda's ashram, which is, or meditation sites, I think in Encinitas, California, there's one, you'll see pictures there of these beings. So clearly they feel that connection.
Well, I have a tendency to agree with that because I see the amount of serenity and the control, not only of the body, but also of those people around him by emanating that serenity, even, you know, when expressing his frustration and also frustrating his enemies, he was serene about it and was able to pass through situations that would have ended in violence without violence for at least 2.5 years in I think, one of the most seriously volatile regions of the world at that time. It probably still is. But the point that I was trying to make is that you kind of breezed through, I say walk on the grass between the sidewalks, you breeze through the idea of spirituality. And I don't want to alienate religious people or people that are strong in their, quote, faith or their tradition by saying the word spirituality. We're talking about a soul connection to some greater intelligence that is uplifting and beneficial or merciful to all life.
Yeah, correct. And also, well, about that time, I'd say that the classic yogic text, in my opinion, is was written by Yogananda, and it's called Autobiography of a Yogi. And in my opinion, in the late 1980s, there was a book came out by Barbara Marciniak called Bringers of the Dawn. And this was my first real encounter with, in book form, of some channeled information that, to me, kind of helped me fill in a lot of information that wasn't taught in the yoga schools. In other words, things like meditation, hatha yoga, pranayams, which are breathing exercises, focusing on attention, raja yoga, all that. There are so many different types of yogas, and of course, most of them have a basis in some types of meditation as well. And when I came across this information from Bringers of the Dawn, really started filling in some gaps that in my personal learning. And the first concept there was that thought creates. And probably synonymous with thought creates, you could use the word belief creates. And more specifically to that, how specifically that works in our 3D reality. Well, it turns out that your thoughts, your emotions, and your definitions actually create a mirror image for you in the world, which becomes your experience. Now, with respect to that one point alone, I'm going to give some specific sources that concur with that conclusion. One in particular was quite interesting, is one of the current scientists that I follow. His name is Greg Braden, and he has passed on to us that some of the most amazing discoveries recently in quantum physics has shown that regardless of your interpretation or belief religiously, spiritually, or whatever your take is on who created what he calls the divine matrix or this holographic universe that we exist in, regardless of your definition of that level of who created that or what energy created that, how that system works right now, they're saying, works exactly like the inside of a computer, like a computer reality scenario. And in that computer reality scenario, there's two basic concepts. One is that the whole system functions on consciousness, and second, that the language of recognition is belief. Now, if you simplify that down, it comes down to the concept of what you believe is. And it's on a very practical level, the most common analogy to that would be the placebo effect. And many people are very aware that in the medical field that many experiments have been done with respect to giving people pills that supposedly are supposed to do something, but in reality they're actually, there's nothing in them other than sugar, but yet they're effective. And the theory being, you know, why does that work? Well, it works because people believe it. And unfortunately, many people haven't made the connection that it just doesn't work in the field of medicine, but it works in all areas. And the information that I've come across with respect to other sources that I consider very credible is a channel from California named Daryl Anka, who channels SSANI information. And the SSANI information also concurs that your thoughts, beliefs, definitions create a perfect mirror image of your life. That's why you're experiencing it. And you're not experiencing that. It's not there to punish you. It's the mirror reflection actually serves as a means to show you what you believe. Because what you believe, you're creating.
Right. It's your
And in this sense, what that does, it has some very amazing implications. Because now, if you're the one that's creating your own experience, well, what about all those things that people are complaining about? And it further psychological studies have now shown that there's three states that identify when someone's in a state of victimhood. And those are when they complain, when they justify their circumstances, and when they blame others or other organizations or whatever. So when you're in a state of blame, complaint, or justification, you're in a state of victimhood. Now, if you're the one who's taking 100% responsibility for your outer experience, then clearly what this is very self-empowering. And what it basically means is that if you're the one who's created it, then you also have the ability to fix it or make alterations to that experience.
Yeah, I think to a large extent that's true. But sometimes we involve ourselves in a larger matrix of beings who also have their wishes and their desires for things to happen, and you're battling against them for position. And so sometimes these things are of your creation. But the fact that you're in the battle, the fact that you're in that competition is your choice. And so therefore what you observe or what you believe is. You just have to observe more consistently and more persistently than the others in that matrix. And, you know, I have some respect for Greg Braden as well. I've been involved in a couple of events that he has done. But I would like to, you know, bring this a little bit more scientific and say that matrix is actually when we talk about mathematics, there's two kinds of mathematics. There's finite math, which is like algebra or trigonometry, and then there's analysis math, which is kind of an ongoing process. It's a machine you put things into and you get things out of. To say that analysis math is created, I think, is flawed, because I think truth is truth is truth. It cannot be any other way. So the fact that the universe exists in three dimensions, or at least 5% of it or so, it is a result of that analysis math being in place. And that in itself is the creation process. Whether there is a supreme single being behind all of that is irrelevant to the awe and respect that you have for the beauty of that system. You will eventually gain a testimony that there is some immense love behind it. And when you do, you will wish no harm on any other being.
Yeah, an excellent point. In fact, some of the ET information suggests that the universe was created with unconditional love. And personally, I would concur with that. Like I said, a point that's possibly only proven by the fact that you are supported 100% in your beliefs. I'd like to throw out here a concept that's quite interesting. It's, of course, not a proven one, and it also goes beyond modern science a step or so. And that's a concept that has been thrown out by the SSANI civilization. It's called the concept of prime radiant. And prime radiant is the concept that everything is actually one thing, and we see it from different perspectives. And that from a purely scientific point of view, they describe it this way, that, of course, for the sake of discussion, we're going to talk about a particle and a wave being the same. So it's kind of a particle wave. But according to the Esasani, everything is one particle or wave that travels at infinite speed, has no mass, and thus breaks no laws of physics. And the best way to actually get a visual comprehension of that particular concept is this. If you took a light bulb and you were in a dark room and you lit it up, that would represent the one particle or wave. Now, if you took another light bulb about 10 feet away and then turned the one off and turned the other one on, you would see that particle in a different place lit up in the second light bulb. But now, if you started turning them off and on, one off, then on, and then off and on, and back and forth and back and forth, and if you did that and keep doing it and increasing the speed of rapidity, you would soon see that it would appear that both light bulbs are on at the same time.
Right.
And that's the concept of the particle, so that theoretically that one particle, if it had infinite speed, could be everywhere at once. And to me, it's kind of an amazing meditation, if nothing else, in terms of seeing a potential oneness of everything that exists in the physical universe.
And then you also realize that your observation may not be the actual reality of what's there. In actuality, that light's flashing off and on 60 times a second. But your eyes and your brain, your physical body, cannot comprehend, cannot pick up that flashing at 60 cycles per second. Your brain tends to blend it all together so that it looks like it's constantly on. And that's kind of what we as humans do with the universe. Unfortunately, if we observe it wrong, then it appears wrong. If we observe it correctly, then it begins to open up to us and reveal truths to us.
Yeah, good point. Yeah. So in bringing that concept up, it was kind of like it's a theory, but it's a theory that I guess sort of in the back of my mind, I kind of think, well, maybe one day science will come around to that one. It seems like a pretty interesting one, and when I look at the progression of where scientists have kind of come along over the past couple of decades. But meanwhile, back at the Belief Ranch, this whole idea then of us taking responsibility for outer creation. Now, in my own personal way of explaining, I talk about us having our own personal what you call collective thinking and belief systems that reflect our own personal beliefs. And actually, in probably more scientific terms, you can't have an experience that you're not a frequency match for. In other words, that belief must have a frequency match someplace, in other words, for you to experience it. And in that regard, the next concept that goes in with this whole idea of taking responsibility for beliefs is that outer circumstances, and this is something that I find is quite fascinating, outer circumstances don't come with built-in meanings. So, for example, you know, we could be sitting at a table and one guy's loves the dinner and another person's allergic to it, our different take on different scenarios, whatever. When we really think about this, most people agree that, outer circumstances don't come with built-in meanings. We tend to, as a group of people, tend to associate certain events with negative scenarios, like an accident of some kind or some event in a family, a breakup or whatever. We tend to associate and place negative beliefs on things. But in point of fact, and this is one of the things that the extraterrestrial, at least in terms of specifically Pleiadian or Esasani teachings, get into, is that outer circumstances don't have built-in meanings. In point of fact, we place a positive or a negative definition on events, which create an emotional response and also creates our experience of that event. And to me, this is a fascinating concept, because What that really means, and now I've been doing this now for over a decade, and even when I used to do my ET Yoga radio show, I used to challenge people in the audience, and I'd say, look, here's a really good practical thing to do. Like, next time that you perceive something that you kind of think is negative, mark that down in a book, but in the meantime, try to muster up as much positive emotion as you can around that experience and throw a positive spin on that experience. And even if you can't see any possible way there's anything good that's going to come from that, and then mark it down and see how it turns out. Now, some things are a lot quicker than others. Some take a long time, actually, before you'll see it. But once you catch on that it works, it's mind-boggling because it does work. And a physical example of that would be someone who's on time for a train to go to work, but the train leaves early, and some people would view that as a negative, and you can sit there and complain about, oh, the train shouldn't have left, I was here on time, and et cetera, et cetera. Or you could sit down on the bench, and all of a sudden another train comes by, and off on that train comes somebody you haven't seen in 20 years, and you can make a connection with them. And so theoretically, by throwing a positive spin on the event, you created a positive experience. And to me, this is something that I've put to practice over the last number of years, and I challenge people to try it because it's an amazing, amazing journey.
Well, yeah, I completely understand that. The idea of creating constructive interference between positive energy and the dreams and hopes that you have for the now or the future of your life are the things that manifest bounty for you in the future. If you're putting out negative feelings like woe is me and they're out to get me and I don't trust anybody and everybody hates me, and then there is the only constructive interference you can have with your idea is to destroy it. So that positive energy is exactly what the masters teach us to do. It's sort of like when you're hang gliding and you're coming in for a landing on a public street and the instructor tells you over the radio, don't look at the green car on the side of the road. Don't look at the green car on the side of the road, because if you do, you're going to hit it. Just look at the center of the road. If you keep your eye on your goal and your landing spot, then that's where you'll land.
A good point. Yeah, yeah. And as well, the concept here around throwing a positive spin is it's again ties into this whole area about emotion and definition and creating a frequency or a physical match in the universe. Now, here's an amazing video, and I'm going to use another Greg Braden one. He's got a video on YouTube, and it's very short. It's about 10 minutes, and it's called Greg Braden Healing Cancer in 3 Minutes, and that's the title of the YouTube. Now, what he's done is he's gone to a hospital over in Beijing, China, and there they have three practitioners. And the three practitioners are basically, they don't use any surgical tools or anything. And a woman from the West goes over, and she's got a fairly large-sized tumor. And inside of less than 3 minutes, and they actually show you the whole operation on film on this video, they cause her tumor to disappear in 3 minutes. Now, it sounds fantastic. It sounds like a miracle by Western standards, but it's been done so many times now over there that it's becoming a technology. And how does that technology correspond to something that's in the real-world physical scientific knowledge? Well, they still have found out in the last decade or so that there's a neural energy center in the heart. And the heart actually has about 5,000 times the magnetism of the human brain. And so basically what we're talking about is how emotions play a huge, huge factor in creating physical reality. And the science behind this particular technique is they're creating a heart coherence with the brain. They are using a word over there, actually, wasa, in their language, closely approximates in English the words already have happened. And with a resonating in the now and creating a heart resonance, they're able to bounce this particular emotion off of what's called the divine matrix, universal intelligence field, or whatever, and the shadow effect is the dissolution or creation of the intent, original intent, which is the healing of this person. And to me, this has just enormous ramifications for a number of things. Number one, in the area of healing, because it clearly these things are happening. And second, that it so ties in with the whole concept that one of the Esasani teachings is that outer circumstances don't matter. State of being is what matters. And it's not so much that outer circumstances are insignificant, but it shows how important is the emotional energy. And I think there's another scientist, I think it's Rupert Sheldrake, that states that it is the emotional frequency that interfaces with the morphogenetic field that, in his opinion, creates our version of reality. And again, this ties back to this whole concept about our definitions, beliefs, and emotions, because emotion with thought creates outer circumstance. And it also ties in with the fact that you can't have an experience you can't experience what you don't contain. In other words, if you don't have the belief, you don't experience it if you don't have a matching frequency out in the outer world. So to me, this is another just an amazing breakthrough that I think probably 10 years from now, if we had this conversation, more and more people are becoming aware of some of these technologies, let's say, or from the Western science perspective, miracles. And exactly how these, and Greg goes into quite some detail in talking about some of the scientific aspect of this.
Well, I understand that, and I think the word scientific is probably in the eye of the beholder. We might have a little brighter fire when it comes to the scientific method than Mr. Braden. We've discussed this many times, and there are. You know, the scientific method is what it is. It's merciless sometimes. I'm coming up to the top of the hour. If you want to hang on for another half an hour, let me take a quick break. Allow me to punctuate my recording, because I have a 3-hour program and we punctuate it each hour so people can podcast it pretty easily. Just hang on and hold for about 5 minutes, and let me play a little bit of music so stations can take a break. Will that be okay?
You bet.
All right. We'll be back right after this. Take it easy for about 5 minutes. We'll be right back with more X Squared Radio and Charles Green.
Her beauty and the moonlight. She tied you to her kitchen chair. She broke your throne and she cut your hair. And from your lips she drew the hallelujah. 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 Hallelujah.
And welcome back to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. We're coming to you live from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains. My guest tonight is Charles Green, former host of ET Yoga, and we're having an interesting discussion on belief systems, spirituality, observation, etc. Don't forget that you should reach out to the Breakthrough Energy Movement Conference coming up October 13th, 10th through 13th this year. All the latest, greatest breakthrough energy devices, energy conservation devices. Our electric truck is going to be there, maybe other technologies as well. Also, don't be too troubled. The entire server is down right now. You can't get to xsquaredradio.com. You can't get to Remembering the Future, Alienated Nation, the nippy North Pole Inner Earth Expedition, because the entire server is down. We do not know why. Sometimes we begin this program on Sunday nights, and about 5 minutes after we start, somebody hacks the server, and down it goes. It just goes down. I don't have time in between the segments to get the server back up and running, so I apologize for that. It's just somebody out there working overtime. It takes me a while to figure it out and fix it. So after the program tonight, I'll have some time, go figure it out and see what blog attack has happened on the website to shut it down. It's not the first time it happened. We had it stopped there for about 3 months, and somebody has figured out how to get back in there. We've changed all the passwords. By the way, we're using iPower, so any of you that are thinking about using iPower, you may want to reconsider spending your $1,000 a year or whatever. Just my thoughts about it. Let's go ahead and bring Charles back on the program. Charles, how are you doing?
Hey, really good, really good.
All right, so what I want to do in this, I've got about another half hour I can give you here. I want to talk about, because a lot of people are getting mixed feelings about getting information, whether it's truth or otherwise, from any other source other than the one true God, so to speak. And I want to talk about how the messages come into you from the ETs. What is it that they're trying to get across to us? Are they just leading us off into the meadow and getting us ready for mass invasion? Or, you know, why are we seeing all these movies out now about brain-eating aliens? What happened to ET? So I'm trying to figure out, I'm trying to resolve this somewhat on the program. We don't talk about it very much anymore because we have, you know, thousands of listeners out there that get so passionate about it. They write me emails and they write me Skype messages during the program like, oh, what are you doing? You know, you're apostatizing. No, I'm not. What I'm trying to do is resolve the question for the average person, how do you know? In philosophy, we prove things. We use deductive syllogisms. We use logics of various kinds, Boolean logic and syllogistic logic. But in testimonies, in beliefs, we go by a very, very powerful feeling that we get that is an overwhelming wash of love. And when you get that feeling, you have what the scriptures call a mighty change of heart. And there are other masters that call it by different names, but it's the same thing. You end up with an overwhelming, peaceful consideration of all life. And you know you're in the wrong place when whoever it is up there at that podium, whoever's banging the tambourine or holding the megaphone, is calling for death and destruction. You are in the wrong place. You need to get out. Okay? So if they're talking about, you know, love and mercy and turn the cheek and let's do what's for the greater good of humanity, you might be in the right place. But I want to talk about that. How do you know? How do you get this information, Charles? And what is it that you can share with us in the next 30 minutes that will enlighten us about this connection?
Well, you certainly covered a lot of ground there, and I'm certainly don't have all the answers, but I do have you know, some perspective on the general topic that you're looking at. I should start off by saying that when I was on the air with ET Yoga, I never ever tried to convince people of even the existence of extraterrestrials, because there's a certain portion of the population that, you know, just can't relate to that concept. But what I've always said is that if the information resonates with you and through your own personal discernment you find the information to be true, or you try out some of the techniques that are suggested, etc., then when you find them good for you, you have a good feeling about things. And I think this is as a general guideline, you know, information should make you feel good. It should make you feel self-empowered. And of course, we all know that the frequencies of unconditional love, gratitude, and compassion are higher frequencies, joy, excitement. These, to me, are the energies that when you are in true alignment with your higher self, those are the feelings that you should be having that kind of tell you that, you know, the compass is pointing north. And when you follow your passion in life and when you follow your excitement in life, these are the things that that tell you that you're on the right track. Now, with respect to this extraterrestrial thing, because extraterrestrials to me are like kind of all over the map. I mean, to me, from a non-provable position, but from my perspective, there are many, many different types of extraterrestrials visiting this planet at this time. Some have their own agendas. The specific ones that I follow in terms of information and where I tend to receive information are specifically Pleiadian, Sirian, Andromedan, Esasani, and Arcturian. And with respect to those groups, and I did mention a book on the show earlier tonight, Bringers of the Dawn, Barbara Marciniak. That's something that I would refer people to in terms of looking to get started if they're interested in this subject area. There's a lot, to me, like in any area, lots of disinformation out there. There's lots of, in my opinion, negative ET groups. In fact, if you wanted to go even probably farther into on that subject, I would say that behind the scenes, this planet has probably been influenced to a very large degree by a group that's not so much interested in our well-being.
But I think that's probably true. I have that exact same feeling that, you know, when you look at, for instance, how pyramids are built or how ancient cities in the Yucatan are built, they take generations to build this stuff. And I can tell you that when engineering projects are handed off, even, you know, in the same year between engineers, the new engineer puts his own spin on things. He puts his own signature, just like presidents do, you know, or secretaries of whatever agency you want. They put their own spin on it because they have their own personality, their own area of expertise, their own aesthetics. But when it comes to this alchemical takeover of the planet, we have been operating for a solid, solid 80 years, and it can be argued about 230 years without deviating from the course 1 millimeter. That takes a being of not only immense power and focus and ability to bring to the line the egos of men generation after generation after generation through wars and bank takeovers and language changes and focus, absolute focus on the goal, which is world domination through alchemy. I agree with you, Charles. There are some beings on this planet that are physical, they are real, they are powerful, and you have never seen them.
Yeah, and I would even go so far as to say that historically, and this is according to several different extraterrestrial groups have indicated that, in point of fact, we were originally created with a 12-stranded DNA to basically operate like so far beyond what most of us operate that it's almost ridiculous that we've had an actual DNA manipulation to make most of the population function on a 2-stranded DNA. And to keep us in a certain frequency range that more approximates fear. Of course, love being an opposite of sorts to that type of energy, I think that I'm very encouraged by the numbers of people that we now see that are trying to work through things like fear. And much of us, I think, or many of us are, and much of the influence on the planet has been to try to keep us in a particular frequency range. And this is something that I think people are becoming more and more aware of, and it's been kept like in the dark side of things, so that we don't even know what it is we're dealing with.
Well, yeah, I tend to agree with that, because it never, this being or these group of beings, they never actually come out and say, here is where we're taking the planet. But when you look backwards through history and you look at, for instance, the influence of, you know, the founding fathers or the Rothschilds with the War of 1812 or the establishment of the Fed or the workings of the IMF or the manipulations of currency and gold and silver, the inflation and collapse of currency globally over and over again, the bringing to the knees of royalties and presidents and whole countries to make them subservient to this one power. You have to believe that there is no one overriding doctrine to which men ascribe and do not deviate generation after generation. There must be a being or series of beings that are working behind the scenes that are trading wealth beyond imagination, power further than most men can sail in a lifetime, in exchange for working this system, being the quote-unquote mouthpiece in front of the teleprompter, getting nation after nation after nation to follow them to the gates of hell.
A good point. And one of the things I try to keep in mind with respect to my own personal evolution is, although you can... the more I think that you advance spiritually, you also become aware of the dark. It doesn't mean that you become it. And in my opinion, the best strategy with respect to the dark is not going against it, because what you go against, you actually serve to perpetuate. It's kind of like the war on terror, the war on cancer, the war on drugs. Whatever you want to go against, you just serve to perpetuate the energy. But you need to go in a clear new direction, a positive new direction. And this is what my experience has shown me, is that when you create a new path, so a positive, so have a positive goal, sort of like peace, the way to peace is to love peace. It isn't to hate war. So it's
That's true, but you got to remember that the system is being set up. Whether you're peaceful or whether you're fearful, you still have to go through the inspection lines at the airport. You still have to buy your licenses and register various equipment and avoid saying or doing certain things in certain places, because liberties, one by one or dozen by a dozen, are being truncated. They're being removed, and we are being herded like cattle or sheep into a chute. And at the end of that chute is a very sharp blade that will take everyone, the fearful and the peaceful. Somewhere along the way, you have to shine that light so bright that the darkness recedes to the edges of reality where it belongs.
But like I said, from a strategic point of view, from my perspective, intention in terms of creating the positive is what, if enough people want to create a positive, you can create it. It's kind of like my thinking is that we have our personal belief system. We also have a global or collective consciousness. It's one of the reasons why those behind the scenes want to try to influence your thoughts and your beliefs so much, why they want your attention like 40 hours a week on television and putting their spin on everything that you see, or at least focusing your attention on something other than creating new positives. So that if you're constantly involved in their game, they're pretty happy with that. Even if you go directly against them, they're pretty happy with that. Like, so without naming names, there are certain programs in the media that appear to be very anti, let's say, this or that. And to my way of thinking, these only serve to perpetuate the dark. So from a personal point of view, I remember answering a question about in 2012, I was on a Unicus radio doing an interview, and some caller called in and asked about 2012 and all the doom and gloom that was supposed to happen in 2012. Well, from my perspective and from many extraterrestrial sources, they kind of look at it this way, that there's an infinite number of universes and they're all being played out. And if your bent is on a very fearful scenario, then there's a very large possibility you could be attracted to a fearful scenario. And even if you notice certain negative things that you would claim as negative to your perception, throwing positive spin on them still is a good thing to do, because you can shift to certain infinite scenarios that turn out to all of a sudden have a lot of people that see things the way you do. So it's kind of like, from a philosophical point of view, a lot of the extraterrestrial information would kind of go like this in terms of analogy. If you took a film strip and ran it through a film projector, what you have is a bunch of still frames. Those still frames have the illusion of motion, and they have the illusion that we would see as, let's say, an outer world. But if there are an infinite number of parallel realities, then we can shift to, which apparently we do all the time, to even create the illusion of motion. If we can shift to frequencies that are more inconsistent with what our intention and our beliefs are, I believe in that. And I think that rather than being in any kind of a fear mode about anything, to me, anything to do with fear has to do with not being in alignment with your higher self. So I want to try to take a positive position on anything, even if it looks from the outside as threatening, because sometimes these threatening things help us to grow, and they help us to move in more positive directions. And I think from my idea of the world is that we can and will in time create a free world and an independent world that is, let's say, a golden age.
Yes, in a golden age, you have a higher resonant frequency that is the result of the proximity of the solar system in, for instance, the precession. You have a totally different set of frequencies that bathe the earth into which men resonate and draw their visions and their inspirations. And so we get this golden age result. Also what happens is that the dark frequencies, the lower frequencies, the more base and banal and, shall we say, lustful frequencies, don't resonate with reality anymore, and they become unaware of the reality of gold or light. Now, interestingly enough, there is one area in space that doesn't change with respect to that precession, and you mentioned Sirius or Sirians. By the way, you can look in the southern sky and you can see the star Sirius. That's not exactly the binary star with our sun. It's the star right behind it that's much, much more dense, but you can't see it because the Sirius that you see, which is Sirius A, is so much brighter, although it's not as dense. That's actually our binary sun, and it's been in the same place for well over 20,000 years. The pyramids are aligned to the star Sirius within one half arc second and have been that way for 11,000 years. It is, for at least the ones who built those pyramids, and I'm not giving the credit to the Egyptians, sorry, there is an alignment as a point of origin, as though it was either Syrians that brought them here or Syrians that brought them knowledge of what to do and how to build and these advanced methods and how to make use of the Earth's energy system, or at least maybe even stay connected to home. And it is the belief of many, and I'm not saying that I'm one of them, and I'm not saying I'm not. It is the belief of many that some of the souls that are here on this Earth are actually incarnated Syrians, because we don't come from stars, we come from planets, and sometimes planets disappear. They're taken out by supernovas, which there was one in the Summer Triangle in about 600 BC. You don't see the supernova anymore. You don't see the red giant that exploded in that area because there's a black hole in the Summer Triangle that consumed all the gas. Otherwise, you'd still be able to see the red gas in the Summer Triangle. So when planets disappear, the abode for all of the, let's call them biological transducers that housed the souls that live there, goes away as well. The souls, like ours, are eternal, and they need somewhere to go, to live. And it is believed by many that some of those souls came here, and they brought some of that memory, whether it's star memory or light memory or even genetic memory, it's hard to tell. Some of that memory came with them, and that it is a memory of light, and it is a memory of a skill, shall we call it, of light and a skill of eternity. And that is why those Syrians are here. Am I pretty close?
Yeah, I would go along with that. In fact, I'd say that from an extraterrestrial perspective, many of us, maybe all, are not originally from here. It's interesting that I always kind of equate Earth with almost like an orphan in sense that doesn't know or who the original parents were. One of the things that they've managed to block from human memory for most people is our extraterrestrial heritage. And there's an interesting couple of books that are out actually right now called Transylvania Sunrise and Transylvania Moonrise.
Wow.
And I don't know if you've heard about this, but it so happened that I happened to be in Romania for about a four-year period during a time when supposedly, and this is all supposition, there's no proof to any of this, but if you read the books, there's at least the people who wrote the books state that they're underneath what's called in Buzău, Romania. There's a rock sphinx there, and underneath in this mountainous area had been discovered the holographic record, historical record of the Earth going back 50,000 years, which I would be just thrilled to have something like that come to the surface so that we could actually take a look at that, because it would certainly cover some of those subjects like the pyramids, etc. And many other issues that for sure the powers that be or the powers that were really don't want you to know about.
We could still go to Romania. Now, I've been to Tibet, and you can't go there anymore. And I've been to Egypt many times, and I'm not saying you can't go to Egypt, but I don't recommend it right now for Westerners. But we could still go to Romania. Let's go and look and see that holographic record for ourselves.
Well, you're not going to go there because, first off, you're not going to have access to it. What you have access to is a cable car up the hill. You can climb all over the rock sphinx. But as far as getting into the what's supposedly been discovered there, no access.
I've heard that before.
Yeah,
if the rumors
are true, quite a fascinating discovery.
Well, I'm fascinated by it, and now it's going to be on my radar.
Wow,
it's been really pleasant. I appreciate it. So what is your thought in closing here about, you know, we hear of Anunnaki, we hear of alien breeding programs, hybrids, things like that. But at the end of the day, once the body is created that can, you know, breathe air and exist on this planet, once the body is created, isn't it really not the choice of the breeder what soul occupies that body? I mean, sure, you might breed an alien and a human together and get a hybrid that's acceptable somewhat in society, although I've seen some pretty strange people. But the actual soul that occupies that biological transducer is the choice of the soul, not of the breeder.
I would go along with that, although I guess what we're talking about here is clearly a manipulation. And from my perspective, what happens during an incarnation is that your higher self basically splits off a portion of itself that into a human form that wants to have a particular experience. And this experience that that I try to focus on for me is this: basically, I'm trying to activate as much latent DNA as possible. I'm trying to open up my chakra system, a new concept in Pleiadian teachings, because we're always taught that there were seven chakras, and I think science has now confirmed that those vortex centers do exist in the physical body. But the Pleiadians also teach that there are five centers outside the body, which I concur with. That in terms of practical techniques and things, and if I might throw a plug in here, is my website's www.etyoga.com. And I do have lots of interesting techniques there and available that people might be interested to browse through. But with respect to this whole idea about personal control and freedom, I think that from what I can make out, yeah, there are forces that are really trying to, they're trying to, in many ways, even take control of the reincarnational system, et cetera. It's very complex, some of their stuff. I'm not privy to a lot of specifics on that subject, although I hear that. But in point of fact, I personally believe, like as you stated, that you know, we've got a lot of there's a lot of good guys out there helping us right now too, behind the scenes, that a lot of things go unnoticed. I personally believe that in fact, about two weeks ago, I was part of a group of thousands, actually, that sent peace energy through Children of the Sun, organized this program of sending peace to the Middle East area, in particular Syria. I'm very interested to see personally how that works out. I think that we have lots of proof in history here. Back in the 70s, there was what's called the Maharishi effect, where 1% of the people meditated. It affected the outer circumstances in the area of crime, and how the crime rate dropped amazingly, like 17-30% or something in certain areas. I really believe that we can affect outer change through millions of people intending certain outcomes. And I really think this is a wave of the future, that as more and more of us become more aware of our spirituality, that we intend a peaceful world. And I really think that in the last card will be an ace, and it'll be played by the good guys.
Yeah, I tend to agree with that. And I find it very interesting that you guys did that, because about that time, there seemed to be some confounding in this plan, this evil plan that has unfolded since Benghazi, to broker all these weapons through Turkey to bad guys to fight bad guys. There seems to be some confounding, and now in the last few hours, it appears that Mr. Obama has backed away from the button. Even though he says he has the right to do it without Congress, he's going to wait on Congress. Congress is likely to say no, or we can't decide. In any case, whatever energy you guys put out does seem to have had its effect.
Well, my personal opinion is that this is ET sources, but I believe it. And what I believe with respect to the world at large is that there is no possibility of a wide-scale nuclear war on this planet. It's just not going to be allowed. The good guys have enough of a hold on what's happening here that it won't be allowed. Now, you can have regional wars, and you can go through all kinds of subtle means, like disease and local wars and vaccine and chemtrail and GMO food and all kinds of other ways to try to mess people's DNA up. But the bottom line is there aren't going to there really hasn't been a threat of any nuclear Armageddon for a long time, and the heads of most states know this.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. I mean, come on. What nation would be insane enough to drop a nuclear bomb on someone else?
And the other thing that we need to learn on this planet is there's only one race on this planet, and that's humans. And it's actually from several very high extraterrestrial races. They absolutely have a very hard time wrapping their heads around the fact that we actually go to war with each other. I mean,
yeah.
this is something that is just it's kind of it's bizarre. And in point of fact, we have enough issues with negative ET involvement here that we really don't need to be fighting among ourselves. I mean, everything affects everything else on this planet, and we really need to learn that war is just not war is inexcusable. There are no excuses for it.
Well, that's true. And don't forget that there are lots and lots of people that firmly believe that Jesus is the Christ and that he's the only begotten of the Father and that he has a plan that may not work perfectly from day to day because we have to be given our free agency. But there is an eschatological recipe, and we seem to be walking very firmly right down the middle of that path. And my assertion, my hope, is that through programs like this, yours, others, that we become aware enough as children of God that we can step off the path and not go to Armageddon at all.
Well, exactly, because in point of fact, and from what I see is the powers that be or the powers that were, whatever you want to call them, what they want to do is see that played out, okay? And that's pretty clearly, that's their agenda. And, of course, because so many millions of people believe in certain things that they've read that are related to religious doctrine, that in point of fact this is going to come about somehow, like somehow this can't be avoided. But in point of fact, yeah, it can. As I said, maybe in different parallel realities, maybe that negative scenario plays out, and I believe that your intent can draw you to the frequency where that, you know, that's not going to be the case. And I personally have a gut feeling that in the last, I don't know when this exact happened, but I think there has been, for me at least personally, I see that there has been some, what, for a lack of a better term, some divine interference in what's going on here on this planet. All of a sudden, it seems like Earth has become very, it's kind of like the battle line's been drawn here. The powers that were in charge here apparently are also being a nuisance in several other places in the galaxy, and they don't want it spreading, and the line's been drawn here. In fact, that's why a lot of ETs that came back to this time period, some incarnated, etc., is because they noticed the tyranny in the universe, traced it back to here, and I think that we're very important.
Yes. I agree with that, and tyranny is alive and well. Charles, it has been an absolute pleasure having you on the program. I want to invite you back very soon. I think we could take this to another level.
Anytime, I'd love to talk about it. And another area that I really feel interested because it ties so much well into self-empowerment is the whole idea of alternative medicine and healing. Because it's a definite offshoot of all of this, and I'd just like to say I've really enjoyed being on air. I think you're a great host, and I'd be blessed to appear again on your show.
Well, I appreciate that very much. I'm humbled to the dust. Again, Charles's website is etyoga.com. Am I right?
Correct.
All right, go there. Participate in his products. We need to get Charles back on the air, by the way, and that takes revenue. So if you buy his stuff, he will feel inspired and thus facilitated to get his airtime activated, and let's get him back on the air. What do you say?
Love it.
All right, my friend. You have an excellent rest of Labor Day weekend, and we'll communicate again soon.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye. All right, Earth Explorers, that was Charles Green. Just such pleasure to speak to people that are not only educated but also communicative, able to put forth their ideas in complete sentences in English and have other people understand them. The reason that I didn't continue with a full 3-hour program with Charles is I want to just get this out there in a little bit at a time, and I want to get some feedback from you as to where we go from here. You know, this is an interactive program. Of course, our number is always 888-429-5471, 888-429-5471. And thank you very, very much for the Skype messages that are coming in. It has helped me and kept me aware of your ideas and your feelings, and I hope that I've expressed those properly. Anywhere else on planet or off planet, if you can dial this number, you can reach here. 530-413-9537. 530-413-9537. I have repaired the server. How I did that while I was talking and listening and all that without seeming distracted, I have no idea. If I did seem distracted, then, well, I don't apologize because I needed to get the server up and going. I want to cover this because it's important that you have this information. We have about an hour and 15 minutes left. And if you have any questions about this, please interact because this is a segment I want to do. We just talked about eschatology, and we talked about this march toward Armageddon that so many traditions are dedicated to, be they Hamas or Baptist. It really doesn't matter. Not much difference when you get right down to it. There's a letter from a Syrian mom, not Sirius the star, Syria the country. And I want to share this letter with you, and I want to open this segment because it's important. We sit on the precipice. We sit on the threshold of walking effectively into the valley of Armageddon. I want to make you aware of it because you're not going to hear this on the mainstream news. And you might hear it on some extreme podcast out there, but you're not going to hear it this way. I try to approach things passionately, but scientifically at the same time. That's why you listen to this program. That's why you share it with your friends. And I appreciate that to no end. Here is the letter. What is lost in the discussion of the Holocaust that is unfolding in Syria is the suffering of the innocent Syrian people. Even with the conflict, is just getting warmed up. I'm just reading this exactly the way it's written. So if it's a little broken English, I'm going to deliver it to you in broken English. An estimated 100,000 Syrians have been brutally murdered. This much is true. Now, these Syrians were not in uniform. All the newscasts that you have seen, the Syrians that you have seen shooting 50 caliber machine guns from the back of a Chevy pickup truck or launching an RPG from a street corner by a pizza cafe where they used to have lunch with their friends at helicopters or tanks or some other mech unit that's rolling down their neighborhood. These people are wearing Nike jogging suits. They're wearing Levi's, okay? They're not wearing uniforms. They don't have gas masks or earplugs. These people have been permanently damaged every time they pull the trigger, every time a trigger is pulled against them. They are fighting tyranny the same way any other people would fight tyranny. And when you watch that newscast and you think about that number, 100,000 Syrians, I want you to think about 100,000 Americans. Because that is exactly what would happen to our country if we tried to rise up and overthrow our government. So when you're thinking about getting with a bunch of your buddies and getting out your hunting rifles and going down to the local whatever and retaking your community by force from a militarized police unit or a militarized military unit, what you see on that news in Syria is your neighborhood. Those 105-millimeter holes in the side of those apartment complex, those are your apartments. Those tank treads across your city park rolling through that gazebo and blasting the glass out of every office building as far as the eye can see, those are your cities. Because that's what happens when a people rises up against its government. She goes on, these events are buried as a whisper in the mainstream media regarding this human tragedy. You see, you don't get the sound when you watch those newscasts. What you get is the actor that's playing a news person, that's reading a teleprompter that is written for them. If you turn down the sound and you watch what's going on the television, you might, and I say you just might, figure out what's going on. Don't make the mistake of looking for government to either care about or try to minimize the loss of life. They don't care. The expression of humanity starts with you, and it starts with me, of course. There is no humanity in government, and there never will be. You know it, and I know it. You feel it. Whether you go get a driver's license or whether you buy a plane ticket, you feel it. Today, we listened to President Obama tell the nation that he was going to approach Congress about attacking Syria. Now, I just have to parenthetically ask the question, seriously? No pun intended. Seriously? Approach Congress about attacking Syria? However, at the end of the day, Obama will attack Syria because he, as this mother has pointed out, is being blackmailed. He has been compromised by the bankers who are holding six Watergate-type events over his presidency. Oh, you want to talk about phony scandals? They're not phony. All they need is a little tiny paper trail. And these phony scandals become very real scandals. And he is compelled to save the petrodollar by eradicating Syria and Iran. Today, a responder to this letter, she writes this letter. She's a mother of two from Syria. In the following paragraphs, here's her case. And I quote, okay, this is a quote from her letter. I am Syrian and a mother since about 2 years. This proxy war installed by the USA and her Western Turkish and Arab lackeys is devastating my homeland and killing my people. I have lost several friends. Your mercenaries shot at me and I got wounded. Some days ago, my daughter, aged 15, said it was better we die now rather than suffering the rest of our lifetime as she expects this war won't end. What shall I say to her at the eye of a huge war to come? That life can be nice in case the greedy U.S. imperialism would allow you to live? Can you really imagine how life is for a 15-year-old teenager seeing bodies in the streets and destruction and displaced people and hearing the shells of the terrorists exploding and the cries of the wounded and the noise of grenades and shooting all day, every day? I want you all to pause for a moment and consider this sound. If you lived in Tulsa or you lived in Cincinnati or you lived in Los Angeles, how would you feel if that was a sound you heard? And I promise you, your police departments are militarized. You don't believe me? Go to the web yourself. Look up police recruitment videos. Watch a few. Any of them. I don't care. Mississippi, Montana, Delaware. I don't care. Pick a state. Pick a police department. Watch their recruitment videos. Tell me that you're watching Andy of Mayberry. You're not. You're not. You're watching war. With who? With who? War in Nebraska? War in Oklahoma City? War in Houston? Are you kidding me? No, I'm not kidding you. You are the enemy of the state. The Syrian mother goes on, with all due respect, in all your words, I do not see any concern about the lives of Syrian women, children, and men, which are threatened and taken away here by your mercenaries of Al-Qaeda. Don't we count? Are we worthless? Now, these aren't her words, they're mine. The mercenaries are Al-Qaeda. They're the ones that cut off the heads of parents in front of their teenage children to bring them in line. They're the ones that we, the United States of America, have supplied with weapons. When Ambassador Stevens was brutally murdered in our embassy, it was within hours of making the deal to broker the stolen weapons from Libya through Turkey to Al-Qaeda. Yep, it's spelled exactly the same. It sounds exactly the same as the words from Mr. Obama's speech. Al-Qaeda is decimated. Al-Qaeda is on the run. Al-Qaeda has had their head cut off because Osama bin Laden is dead. Utter and complete nonsense and propaganda. We are supplying the weapons to Al-Qaeda. We are the ones. That's why those people that worked at Benghazi have been saddled with a gag order, with a non-compete, a non-disclosure agreement. They can't speak to anyone. They can't even speak to Congress. Not allowed to. Why? Because they would reveal that we're the ones that supplied the weapons, the missiles, the grenades, the rockets, the gas, the chemicals. We're the ones that supplied it. She goes on to say, if war breaks out in Syria, the best possible outcome will be the approximately 2 million innocent people will perish, and the world will witness the installation of the Muslim Brotherhood, as they did in Egypt, as they did in Libya, as we destroyed the government that was in place and left it in chaos so the Muslim Brotherhood could move in. She goes on, I have always written and spoken of the Syrian female reporter who was raped by a CIA, Al-Qaeda-backed rebel leader a few months ago. And please, sir, do not name Assad that negatively, recognizing that even your CIA had to admit and report to it that he has the utter loyalty of about 70% of the Syrian people. How much support can Obama gain in the United States? 47%? 48%? That's all it takes to win the presidency anymore. So we are Syrians, dumb to follow a dictator? No. We are united with our family, friends, our sons and husbands, serving in our army to defend our homeland. Every U.S. American would do the same if the USA was attacked. And we stand with our president, and we realize that he does his duty to defend his people. You do not need to be a fan of someone in order to be fair. Apart from that, she goes on, I am optimistic that we Syrians already have won the war against you. By all evidence of high moral dignity and the persistent will to defend our nation, we Syrians show the world that resistance against the evil can work, and in any case will help you to preserve your dignity. Now, I'm going to play a little audio link for you, as I usually do, just to back it up. This is international news, and I'm going to play it for you. So it's a collage with some music behind it. So just pay attention, listen closely. It's about 10 minutes long, and we'll see you right afterward. Don't go away. Here we go.
Barack Obama and David Cameron have threatened Syria's government with a serious response if it's confirmed the authorities in Damascus gassed hundreds of people on Wednesday. Meanwhile, Assad's administration has warned against a U.S.-led intervention, saying the move would set the Middle East ablaze.
Syrian state television is reporting that Syrian soldiers entered a number of tunnels that had been used by rebel fighters in Damascus, and there they found empty shells, the remnants of chemical agents. This comes as the United States starts moving its naval ships in the Mediterranean closer to the Syrian coast. The indications on the ground are that the first wave of preparations for any kind of military intervention inside Syria are underway, and that the U.S. and in particular the Navy is just waiting for the green light.
Seeing quite a lot of chips come into place here, Paula. You talk about the military posturing on the part of Washington with a fourth warship heading to the region.
Now to the deepening crisis in Syria. Today, Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel said the U.S. is preparing for all options there. As speculation rises that the U.S. is planning to strike, this as doctors inside Syria confirmed they treated thousands of people who were victims of what appears to be a chemical attack. Our chief foreign correspondent, Richard Engel, is in Turkey near the Syrian border this morning. Richard, what's the latest?
Over the last several days, they have received large shipments of weapons, tons of weapons going to the Syrian opposition, coming through Turkey, in fact, coming through this area. And they also say that they believe they have evidence that Bashar al-Assad personally ordered those alleged chemical attacks on the outskirts of Damascus.
We're reporting from a region on the brink, and all eyes are on Syria, where an apparent chemical weapons attack could lead to American military action. Here in Cairo, we're just 100 miles from the Mediterranean Sea, where U.S. warships are now at the ready.
This morning, officials tell ABC News that U.S. Navy destroyers now in the Mediterranean could be used to carry out limited military strikes, cruise missile strikes.
What a lot of analysts are already describing is the turning point in a regional conflict between Sunni-allied states and Shia-allied states. So it's a very dangerous situation that a military intervention could make much bigger and much, much worse.
U.S. warships are moving off the coast of Syria, preparing for an attack.
This is what is the reality, and this is what many of us have feared for many years now. This is bigger than just the war with Syria. What we're talking about here is World War III.
It's likely cruise missiles launched from those destroyers, targeting key Assad military command posts.
Government officials telling us the case for military action is taking shape.
We'll take a quick break. We'll be right back after this. Don't go away. More X Squared Radio coming to you after little Lisa. Welcome back to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. We're coming to you live from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains. Let us continue. So the question is, was gas used? And the answer is yes, it was. Sarin gas, a despicable derivative of a simple bean. What happens when you breathe it in or get it on your skin? It shuts off the communication between your brain and your lungs. But the question is, who used it? Can we trust our media? Can we trust their media? As the U.S. considers a response to what it calls a chemical weapon attack by Syria's Bashar al-Assad regime that killed hundreds of civilians, reliable Middle Eastern sources say they have evidence the culprits actually were the rebel forces trying to take over the government. Well, that one sentence is so full of falsehood, I don't even know where to begin. The U.S. considers a response to what it calls a chemical weapons attack by Assad. Reliable Middle Eastern sources say they have evidence the culprits were actually rebel forces. And then they include the statement trying to take over the government. All of that may be false. How do I know that? Because Secretary of State John Kerry accused the Assad government Monday of covering up the use of chemical weapons in a cowardly crime and a moral obscenity that shocked the world's conscience. And within minutes, the Assad regime came back and called Kerry a liar on World Press. Mr. Kerry is a liar. Oh, so diplomatic. Kerry claimed the Obama administration had undeniable evidence that the Assad government was culpable in the use of chemical weapons on civilians in the August 21st attack. Well, where did they get this evidence? Well, I'm so glad that you asked that question. 3 days before the rockets fell in eastern Damascus, a team of Syrian specialists gathered in the northern suburbs of Adra for a task that U.S. officials say had become routine in the third year of the country's civil conflict, filling warheads with deadly chemicals to kill Syrian rebels. The preparations, as described by U.S. intelligence analysts, continued from August 18th until just after midnight on August 21st. When the projectiles were loaded into rocket launchers behind the government's defensive lines. Then, at 2:30 a.m., half a dozen densely populated neighborhoods were jolted awake by a series of explosions, followed by an oozing blanket of suffocating gas. Unknown to Syrian officials, U.S. spy agencies recorded each step in the alleged attack. Those records and intercepts are the core of the Obama administration's evidentiary case linking the Syrian government to what one official called an indiscriminate, unspeakable horror. Well, I have a question for you, if this statement is true. If you are a reporter and you're watching, let's say, a toddler who has wandered away from his mother, and you begin rolling the camera while you're speaking into the microphone that only your cameraman can hear, only the engineer in the van can hear. I am now filming a toddler that has walked away from an inattentive mother who is obviously looking at what's in the window of the department store and not paying attention to her toddler. The toddler is wandering toward the curb and is about to walk into the street, a busy highway. And the toddler steps off the curb and wanders into the traffic and is run over by a delivery van. And you caught the whole thing on film. An indiscriminate, unspeakable horror. And you have to ask yourself, why didn't the cameraman put the camera down and go grab the hand of the toddler and say, hey, little guy, let's wander back over here to your mom. Okay, that's cool. Mom, hey, you know, pay a little more attention here. Your little guy here, he was wandering toward the street. Can you imagine how her heart would have broken if you would have just sat there and filmed the whole thing? If U.S. spy agencies recorded each step in the alleged attack, why did they not step in and stop those rounds from being fired? A picture downloaded from Brown Moses' blog, a Leicester-based blogger monitoring weapons use in Syria, shows the height of a rocket used in the alleged chemical attack. It's about 4 feet tall. The assessment released on Friday by the White House asserts that U.S. officials tracked the firing of chemical munitions, which were launched by artillery batteries from government-held positions and landed in rebel-held or contested neighborhoods and suburbs east of the capital. The high civilian death toll apparently triggered a panic inside the Syrian regime, U.S. intelligence officials concluded. If that claim is true, that they watched the entire thing, why the indecision? Why come to the press and say, we're still trying to collect information, we don't really know who used these weapons, it's unclear, we're still gathering evidence, blah, blah, blah. Why not come forward with the drone footage showing it happen? Does it sound like a lie to you? Do you think Mr. Assad is right? Or do you actually trust John Kerry? In an intercepted message, a senior Syrian official was overheard confirming that government troops had launched the August 21st attack and expressing concern that a visiting team of UN weapons inspectors would find out about it. A Syrian chemical weapons team was directed to cease operations, the U.S. assessment said. Soon afterwards, Syrian troops began an intensified barrage on the same neighborhood using conventional artillery in an apparent effort to cover up the evidence. In the 24-hour period after the attack, we detected indications of artillery and rocket fire at a rate four times higher than the 10 preceding days, the assessment said. And so the waters continue to get muddy. The streets continue to get smoky. The accusations are flying first one way and then the other. And one doesn't know what is propaganda and what is real. And in the chaos, when things are unclear, when the actual next step might cause consequences that would go down in history as a blunder like unto the Civil War in the United States. At the National Council of State Legislatures last week in Atlanta, a number of lawmakers said they're preparing legislation similar to a bill introduced in Maine recently, did under the leadership of Representative Andrea Boland. Efforts are underway to press the membership of the NCSL to address the EMP issue, since the federal government has failed to take action to mitigate the potential for a catastrophic event. I can just tell you that Obama has stepped away from the trigger. We don't really know what's going on. And so we're backing away from the trigger. If we bomb Syria, what are the consequences? As U.S. warships gather off the shores of Lebanon to launch Tomahawk cruise missiles at targets in Syria, we can make some educated guesses of what the unintended consequences could be. Syrian anti-aircraft batteries will fire their rockets at incoming U.S. missiles, and they may hit some. They may actually fire on the ships that are firing the missiles. You know, a Navy can defend itself against the Navy. But a Navy can't defend itself against an entire country. Many Syrians on the ground will die, and both U.S. and Syrian governments will say the deaths are the fault of the other. It's sort of like you're resisting arrest, and so the policeman is pounding your face into the asphalt. He's kicking you in the back of the head. He's breaking your arms and your fingers. He's scraping your jaw against the street while he's yelling at you to stop resisting arrest. You end up in jail with a broken arm, a dislocated elbow, broken fingers, a shattered cheekbone, perhaps diminished eyesight for the rest of your life. And you say to yourself, why in the world did this policeman do this to me? And the judge simply says, you were resisting arrest. Both are blaming the other. The U.S. Embassy in Damascus will be attacked and burned, as many other U.S. embassies and businesses in the Middle East have already undergone. Syria might also launch rockets toward the U.S. ally in the region, Israel. Certainly Hamas will. Certainly Hezbollah will. Certainly Iran will feed it. Israel would launch bombing missions on Syria, as it has three times in the past 2 years, and perhaps take the opportunity to launch an attack on Syria's strongest ally in the region, Iran. Iran, a country with a population of 80 million, largely westernized, many educated in the West, bright, intelligent, peace-loving people, not the government, not the religious leadership, but the people. They have the largest military in the region, and they have been untouched by war in the past 25 years. And they might just retaliate with missiles aimed toward Israel and toward nearby U.S. military bases in Afghanistan, Turkey, Bahrain, Qatar. Iran could block the Straits of Hormuz and impede the transport of oil out of the Persian Gulf. And let me just put in parenthetically here, if so much as a rowboat sinks in the Straits of Hormuz, you're looking at $5 a gallon gasoline. If a naval vessel sinks in the Straits of Hormuz, if Iran goes out there and sinks some old tankers, creating an artificial reef which prevents those naval vessels from escaping the Persian Gulf, you're looking at $10 a gallon gasoline. You're looking at a complete collapse of the petrodollar, absolute and total disarray. That, as the Obama administration lawyers and the Justice and State Departments frantically write classified legal opinions to provide legal protection for whatever action the president decides on. By the way, this is the same Justice Department that has been found in contempt of Congress, that has violated the law, that refuses to enforce the law as it is written. That one, on August 31st, which was yesterday, 13 former officials of the U.S. government, including Pentagon Papers whistleblower Dan Ellsberg, retired CIA analyst Ray McGovern, retired U.S. Army Colonel Larry Wilkerson, former Chief of Staff for Secretary of State Colin Powell, wrote an open letter to General Martin Dempsey, Chairman of the Joint Chief of Staff, naming him, asking him to resign rather than follow an illegal order to attack Syria. Quote, we refer to your acknowledgement in your letter of July 19th to Senator Carl Levin on, and by the way, he's a Democrat, on Syria, that a decision to use force is not one that any of us takes lightly. It is no less than an act of war. It appears that the president may order such an attack or act of war without proper congressional authorization. As seasoned intelligence and military professionals solemnly sworn to support and defend the Constitution of the United States, not the President of the United States, we have long been aware that from private to general, it is one's duty not to obey an illegal order. If such were given, the honorable thing would be to resign rather than be complicit. I give you the letter. Dear General Dempsey. Let's see if I can. I'm going to read it here in just a little bit. Presumably, there has not been enough time to give Senator Levin's committee an equivalent assessment of the implications of the new option described by the president Wednesday evening, just a few days ago, as a tailored, limited response to the chemical weapons attack on August 21st that has been told was carried out by Syrian government forces. President Obama said, without elaboration, that a retaliatory strike is needed to protect U.S. security. That is bull hockey. A retaliatory strike is needed to protect Obama's integrity because he drew a line in the sand and somebody over there crossed it. He's the one that drew the line in the sand, not the U.S. military. And by the way, Senator Levin, who is a Democrat, and President Obama are at odds with one another because if you'll recall, when the NDAA, Defense Authorization Act, Senator Levin took out the language that allowed what we call prolonged detention. That is that the U.S. military can seize, arrest, and sequester any American citizen it wishes with no due process, no lawyer, no just cause, no habeas corpus, sequester them for something in the future that they might do. Senator Levin took that language out of the law, and President Obama put it back. So all is not hunky-dory up there in Democrat land. It is precisely this kind of unsupported claim that needs to be subjected to rigorous analysis by both the Pentagon and Congress before the president orders military action. For some unexplained reason of urgency, that order may come within the next day or two. With no wish to prejudge the results of analysis presumably underway, we feel it our responsibility to tell you, General Dempsey, now, that speaking out of several hundred years of collective experience in intelligence and national security matters, we strongly believe that the president's reference to a military strike on Syria being needed to protect U.S. security cannot bear close scrutiny. In other words, it's bull hockey. In all candor, the credibility of his chief national security advisors, Valerie Jarrett, and his own credibility have been seriously damaged in recent months, giving all the more urgency and importance to the need for Congress to exercise its constitutional role regarding war. And as usual, there are serious problems with the provenance and nature of the intelligence that is being used in support the need for military action. In your July 19th letter to Senator Levin, you emphasized, General Dempsey, as we weigh our options, we should be able to conclude with some confidence that the use of force will move us toward the intended outcome. Once we take action, we should be prepared for what comes next. Deeper involvement is hard to avoid, you know. We should act in accordance with the law and to the extent possible in concert with our allies and partners. Oops, we don't have any. This last sentence raises, first and foremost, the question of what the Constitution says of the role of Congress in authorizing a military attack that, in your words, is no less than an act of war, General Dempsey. It also raises the important issue of how seriously we should take the result of democratic parliamentary procedures among our allies, France, Britain, others that have said, Australia have said, we will not participate, mate. Although not legally required to do so, British Prime Minister David Cameron on Thursday sought parliamentary approval for military action against Syria, and guess what? He was rebuffed. The answer was no. It was put to a vote, and the nays had it. With as much grace as he could summon, Cameron said the British people had expressed their will, and he would not flout it. Although he could do so legally in the British system, he did not. Here's what he said. It is clear to me that the British Parliament, reflecting the views of the British people, does not want to see British military action. I get that. And the government will not, and the government will act accordingly. A tense-looking Cameron said immediately after the vote. His service in office will survive. French President François Hollande, as you know, a socialist, has said his country may still strike Syria to punish it for allegedly using chemical weapons despite the British Parliament's failure to endorse military action. If Fiji can be lined up again, that would make a coalition of at least three. Fiji, France, and the U.S. I'm sorry. I wouldn't go to a rodeo with that team. Wouldn't happen. It'd be the worst presidential decision since the decision of the North to go to war with the South. Before the president spoke on Wednesday, the ranking member of the House Judiciary Subcommittee on the Constitution and Civil Justice, Gerald Nadler, issued a formal statement titled "Constitution Requires Congressional Authorization on Use of Force Against Syria." Here's what he wrote, quote, "The Constitution requires that, barring an attack on the United States or an imminent threat to the U.S., any decision to use military force can only be made by Congress, not by the president. You want a test of wills? Here is a test of wills, my Earth explorers. The decision to go to war, and we should be clear, launching a military strike on another country, justified or not, is an act of war, is reserved by the Constitution to the American people acting through their elected representatives in Congress." He goes on, "Since there is no imminent threat to the United States, there is no legal justification for bypassing the constitutionally required congressional authorization. Consultation with Congress is not sufficient. The Constitution requires congressional authorization, Mr. President." He goes on, "The American people deserve to have this decision debated and made in the open public with all the facts and arguments laid out for public review and debate, followed by a congressional vote. If the president believes that military action against Syria is necessary, he should immediately call Congress back into session and seek the constitutionally required authorization." Well, guess what? As of Thursday, more than a third of the House of Representatives have spoken out against being marginalized, as they were before Libya, as they were before Pakistan. Many insisting that there be congressional debate and a vote before any military strike on Syria. It's the right thing to do, Mr. President. In addition, Republican House Speaker John Boehner said or sent Obama a letter Wednesday urging him to make the case to the American people and Congress for how potential military action will secure American national security interests, preserve America's credibility, deter the future use of chemical weapons, and critically, be a part of our broader policy and strategy. Brilliant statement, Mr. Boehner, if I do say so myself. The president called Boehner on Thursday, the next day, to brief him on the status of deliberations over Syria, according to Boehner's spokesman, who added that during the call, the speaker sought answers to concerns outlined in his letter, including the legal justification for any military strike. But after the call, Boehner reportedly complained that his questions had not been answered. No kidding. Well, just what should we do? Well, here's what a bunch of elementary school children did. Elementary school children learn that in view of the founder's experience with English kings, it was not by chance that in crafting the Constitution, they took care to give our elected representatives in Congress the exclusive power to declare war and to raise and support armies. It's Article 1, Section 8, if you're looking it up. The somber historical consequences of letting this key power of Congress fall into disuse after World War II. In effect, it allowed presidents to act like kings, speak eloquently to the folly of ignoring Article 1, Section 8. We've done it over and over and over again. We did it in Bosnia, we did it in Pakistan, we did it in Libya, and it goes on and on and on. And yet, there is no sign that President Barack Obama intends to request congressional authorization before he orders military action against Syria. Indeed, he and his top appointees, you know, the secretaries, and, of course, his boss, Valerie Jarrett, have been openly contemptuous of the congressional role of Congress in such matters. What do they know? Valerie Jarrett knows best, the Iranian-born communist. Obama's former defense secretary, Leon Panetta, was smoother and more wise old handish than his predecessors in emasculating congressional power. Emasculating. It means to cut off the balls. Thanks to Panetta, we have direct insight into how the Obama administration may strike Syria with very little consultation, not to mention authorization from Congress. And that's called fanning the chin. Fanning the chin. Watch the Three Stooges. You'll know exactly what I'm talking about. You fan the chin. Like, go take a hike, Congress. Several of us remember watching you in some distress sitting next to your then boss, Panetta, as he tried to put Senator Jeff Sessions, that's the Republican from Alabama, you know, in his place at a hearing of the Senate Armed Services Committee on March 7th in 2012, chafing belatedly over the unauthorized nature of the war in Libya. Sessions asked repeatedly, what legal basis would the Obama administration rely on to do this in Syria, what he did in Libya? You remember that, don't you? When he said, we'll consult with the UN. Panetta stonewalled time after time, making it abundantly clear that the Obama administration does not believe it needs congressional approval for wars like the one in Libya. Sessions, you'll remember, he said, I'm really baffled. The only legal authority that's required to deploy the U.S. military in combat is the Congress and the President and the law and the Constitution. Panetta's response did nothing to relieve Sessions' bafflement. We're talking about Leon Panetta here, the pinnacle of experience in statesmanship when it comes to the Defense Department. Here's what he said. Let me just for the record be clear again, Senator, so there's no misunderstanding. When it comes to national defense, the president has the authority under the Constitution to act to defend this country, and we will, sir. You will remember Panetta's attitude, which Senator Sessions called breathtaking. You said nothing then, and we can understand that. But frankly, we are hoping that you had that awkward experience in your mind when you reminded Senator Levin that we should act in accordance with the law. Clearly, there is an important constitutional issue here. The question is whether you will again choose to be silent, or whether you will give Secretary Chuck Hagel and the President notice, Mr. or General Dempsey, that your oath is to support and defend the Constitution, precludes complicity in the end-running Congress on Syria. Here's the final part of this letter. Are you ready for this? We do not understand why the White House has so far been unwilling to await the results of the UN inspection in Damascus. By the way, they left yesterday. But we are all too familiar with what happens once the juggernaut starts rolling to war. It isn't just a few cruise missiles, and then we take the Navy and we go home and tap the kegger. However, if despite Thursday's vote in the British Parliament and the increased opposition in Congress to war without the authorization of Congress, the President decides to order an attack on Syria, we urge you, General Dempsey, to act in accordance with your solemn oath to support and defend the Constitution, as well as your own conscience. In such circumstances, General, we believe strongly that you should resign and explain your reasons at once to the American people. So that is my half hour this hour on Syria. Now, I mentioned earlier the EMP, incorrectly so. I was talking about Syria, and I had put this paragraph in the wrong place. We had talked earlier about the National Energy Reliability Corporation and how they had created this massive central grid in the United States. There's a similar organization in Europe as well. In a sense, it's a good idea because you can take excess power in Niagara and you can route it to Phoenix, etc. But it also creates a vulnerability, and that vulnerability has been addressed many, many times, and we covered a multi-hundred-page report where these potential threats, which actually wouldn't be threats at all if we didn't have a central grid, were addressed in some detail. One of those is the electromagnetic pulse. It could come from the sun. It could come from, God forbid, a nuclear weapon. So Mr. Pry, that's a good name for a guy in the CIA, Mr. Pry, who was a CIA analyst and staff director of the congressionally mandated EMP Commission, who is also the executive director of the Task Force for National and Homeland Security, a congressional advisory group. The second resolution called on Congress to support state-led initiatives like Maine's recently enacted LD-131 legislation sponsored by Boland to protect state grids from an electromagnetic pulse, whether it comes from the sun or whether it comes from a weapon. It also asked Congress pass no law interfering with state efforts to pass and implement such initiatives. And believe me, there's been a lot of interference on the federal level. The Department of Energy, the Department of Interior, Interstate Commerce, all falls on top of this utility. Not just the price controls, but also the managing of the utility. And the National Electrical Reliability Corporation, even though it's a private corporation, believe me, it works with a lot of federal authority. A majority voted in favor of the second resolution, although approving a resolution requires the support of three-quarters of the voters. That has yet to be done, but it's expected that it will pass. Pry said the resolutions will be taken up again at the next NCSL, slated for December. He was pleased with their reception since it was the first time the EMP issue had been raised at the NCSL. He says, "We're running out of time to protect the grid," Pry said. Why he says that, I have no idea. Maybe it's the fact that, you know, he is a former CIA operative. But he goes on to say the solar maximum is upon us. Millions of cyber attacks are already happening daily, and saboteurs using AK-47s damaged grid transformers outside San Jose, California in April. In July, a North Korean freighter was intercepted carrying nuclear-capable missiles. Connect the dots, my friends. The last time we failed to connect the dots, 9/11 happened and thousands of Americans died. If we don't connect the dots this time, the lights go out. Pry pointed out that the greatest opposition to the resolutions at the NCSL was the North American Electrical Reliability Corporation, as I just stated. They're the ones that are standing in the way of states taking control of their own grids. Okay? Allegedly, let's see, he says that the NAERC, which represents the state utilities and allies such as the Rural Electric Cooperative Association, the NERC has said that it is up to the U.S. Department of Defense to handle protection of the grid against EMP, even though the responsibility comes under the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. The Defense Department has testified to Congress that it has 99% reliance on the U.S. electrical grid system for maintaining its bases and being prepared to meet any national security emergency, which means if the grid goes out, there's a 99% chance that they can't do a darn thing about it. They can't make a phone call. They couldn't deliver the first MRE. They couldn't deliver the first helicopter. They couldn't make the first airdrop if that grid goes down. And believe me, I'm in the business. Many, many proposals have been made to the Defense Department. And many, many trips have been made by me and by people here in North Carolina. We've gone to Congress. We stood in the congressional auditorium and told them about this 2 years ago. We went to the Pentagon and sat in those meetings, and we told them that this would happen, or that this could happen. When the grid goes dark, so does the military installation. And there is no non-tactical military installation anymore. The battlefield is integrally connected with the military installations that are back home. Somebody at Nellis Air Force Base is flying a drone in Afghanistan by satellite. Get it? The battlefield is compromised when a domestic installation goes dark. And 99% of them rely on the U.S. electrical grid system. Now you understand the vulnerability. Now you understand the mission criticality of putting these V2G systems together the way we have designed them. And yet, here we are, 3 years later, and not one nickel, not one penny has been spent to put that system together. Oh, I made a mistake. I'm sorry. Millions, perhaps billions of dollars have been spent, but nothing's been built. Why? Because they're just spending the money. They're not going to the actual vehicle providers to get the electric vehicles in place that can support that grid. Oh, we're working on it. We're working on it. We're supposed to be delivering by January. But take a look at the calendar, my friends. It's September. You can't make orders in September and take delivery in January. Hello, if you're listening, it can't be done. It cannot be done. You have to place your orders now. All right. We have about 15 minutes left, maybe a little less. I want to talk about heavy metal. This has been rumored to have special properties. We call it gravity and gravity B. Element 115. The classic periodic table, for those of you that understand chemistry, the periodic table is sort of like the menu of all the elements that are available here on Earth. We talk about alien things. We talk about sometimes elements that don't exist on the periodic table. Well, there's one that doesn't. Well, it does, but it only appears for a few milliseconds and then it goes away. Scientists say they've created a handful of atoms of the elusive element 115, which occupies a mysterious corner of the periodic table. That's the super heavy element has yet to be officially named, but it is temporarily called unimpentium. It's roughly based on the Latin and Greek words for the digits, 115. It might as well be called unobtainium. However, 115 has some pretty unique properties in that it has gravity and gravity B. That is internal gravity, quantum gravity, and external gravity, which is significantly strange because we don't normally see this on an atomic level. It normally takes something, well, much larger, like an asteroid or a planet. We don't see it too much on the atomic level. And it's quite possible that electrically or electromagnetically that this gravity B could be amplified. And if 115 could be made to be stable, and I'll tell you how they make it in just a minute and why it's unstable, but if it be made to be stable, have an equal number of neutrons and have an equal number of electrons, then you could amplify that gravity and you could create gravity drive. Okay, the atomic number is the number of protons an element contains. The heaviest element commonly found in nature is uranium, which has 92. But scientists can load it up with more protons and more neutrons into an atomic nucleus and make heavier elements through nuclear fusion reactions. They actually accelerate neutrons and slam them into it and to make it stick to it heavier and heavier. Of course, those neutrons want to come off in the form of, you know, alpha radiation. And when they do, they generate a lot of energy and can be used to boil water. And, well, you get the picture. Scientists hope that by creating heavier and heavier elements, they will find a theoretical island of stability. That's what I'm talking about. An undiscovered region in the periodic table where stable, super heavy elements with as yet unimagined practical uses might exist, like anti-gravity. In experiments in Dubna, Russia, about 10 years ago, researchers reported that they created atoms with 115 protons. We read you some of those papers a number of years ago. Their measurements have now been confirmed in experiments at the GSI Helmholtz Center for Heavy Ion Research in Germany. To make unimpentium in the new study, a group of researchers shot a superfast beam of calcium, which has 20 protons, at a thin film of americium. That's the element with 95 protons. When these atomic nuclei collide, some of them stick together to create short-lived atoms with 115 protons. 20 plus 95 is 115. Get it? Okay. We observed 30 in our three-week-long experiment. Study researcher Dirk Rudolph, a professor of atomic physics at Lund University in Sweden, said in an email, Rudolph added that the Russian team had detected 37 atoms of element 115 in their earlier experiments. The results are, by and large, compatible, Rudolph said. Super heavy elements are generally unstable and most only last a fraction of a second before they start to decay. The scientists had to use special detectors to look for the energy signatures for the X-ray radiation predicted to be given off by elements 115 as it quickly degrades. I told you, as these protons and neutrons come off, they generate photons, some of them in the X-ray band. It's called fluorescence, X-ray fluorescent spectroscopy, or XRF. We use it, we program it, and you can look for actually extremely rare scintillations that are given off, or shall I say fluorescing, as these neutrons come off, protons come off, the electrons fall into lower shells, and they generate X-rays, and that's what we pick up. A committee from the International Union of Pure and Applied Chemistry, which that's all also called IUPAC, which governs chemical nomenclature, will review the new findings to decide whether more experiments are necessary before Element 115 gets an official name. Some of Element 115's neighbors have already been christened last year. The man-made elements 114 and 116 were named Flerovium, that's FL, and Livermorium, LV. The new experiments will be detailed in the physical review letters. And so as we march on with our technology, I pray, I hope that our wisdom marches on with it. I have my doubts. If we're still monkeying around whether we're going to go blow something up in another country to make a point so that we can save face for a little red line we drew on some imaginary, you know, you better not do this, guys, or I'm going to come and blow up your pizza parlor. I mean, this is just, you get it. You get it. But our wisdom needs to advance. And some people are more worried about that than you might think. You know, Rick Rashid, he's a researcher, and he's understandably nervous about this. We venture into the realm of let's call it artificial intelligence. We have a lot of that, especially in Washington. People that wear suits, walk up to microphones, read teleprompters are artificially intelligent. Anyway, as he stepped onto the stage to address 2,000 researchers and students in Tianjin, China, he was risking ridicule. I don't know if you know this or not, but the scientific community can be rather brutal. You step forward to make your scientific point, your what we call a poster. You put your slide up there and you talk about it. Other scientists can stand up and excoriate you on stage. And I don't know if you know many nerds, but we typically are not people of high ego. So if you beat us up on stage, we're liable to pee our pants, or worse. Some scientists have been known to go home and commit suicide. Oh, yes. Oh, yes, absolutely, it has happened. Brilliant physicists have gone and made their presentations and been ridiculed so badly from the religiosity in the physics community that scientist went home and killed himself. So he was nervous. He doesn't speak Chinese. His translator's poor skills in the past promised embarrassment. Here's what he said. We hope that in a few years we'll be able to break down the language barriers between people, the senior vice president of Microsoft Research told the audience. There was a tense 2-second pause before the translator's voice came through. Rashid continued, "Personally, I believe this is going to lead to a better world." Pause, repeat in Chinese. He smiled. The crowd was applauding every line. Some people even cried. This seemingly overenthusiastic reaction was understandable because Rashid's translator had come far. Every sentence was understood and delivered flawlessly. And the most impressive part? The translator was not human. Performing such a task was once far beyond the abilities of the most sophisticated artificial intelligence and was not for want of effort. For years, artificial intelligence was dominated by grand plans to replicate the performance of the human mind. We dreamed of machines that could understand us, recognize us, and help us make decisions. In the past few years, we have achieved those goals, but not in the way the pioneers imagined. So have we worked out how to replicate human thinking? Oh, far from it. Instead, the founding vision has taken a radically different form. Artificial intelligence is all around you, and its success is down to big data and statistics. Making complex calculations, using huge quantities of information, we have built minds, but they're not like ours. Their reasoning is unfathomable to humans, and the implications of this development are now attracting, well, concern. As we come to rely more and more on this new form of intelligence, we may need to change our own thinking to accommodate it. Does this sound a little bit like war games? Do you expect to hear the question someday, "Want to play a game?" More than half a century ago, researchers laid out a series of goals that would bring us closer to machines with human-like intelligence. We had a shopping list of things we wanted to do from the 1950s. Many of the items on the list could be traced back to the mechanization of thought processes conference in 1958 in Teddington, London, which brought together not just computer scientists, but physicists, biologists, psychologists, too, all excited by the prospect of building a thinking machine in our image. Well, they kind of gave up. But that was the breakthrough. As soon as we gave up the attempt to produce mental psychological qualities, we started finding success. Specifically, they jettisoned pre-programmed rules and embraced machine learning. With this technique, computers teach themselves to build patterns from data. With enough information, you can get a machine to learn to do things that appear intelligent. But be it understanding voices, translating language, recognizing faces, when you pile up enough bricks and stand back, you see a house, right? Here's roughly how it works. Really quickly, because we're almost out of time. Most of the most successful machine learning systems are built on Bayesian statistics, a mathematical framework that lets us measure likelihood. It's not Boolean. It's not if, then, and, or. It measures probabilities. It puts a number of to the plausibility of an outcome, giving the context and previously observed correlations, constantly rewriting the algorithms, adjusting the weight and the context that's put together with this data. Let us say that we want an artificial intelligence to answer questions about a simple topic, like what cats like to eat, for instance. The rule-based approach is to build from scratch a database about cats and their dietary habits with logical steps. With machine learning, however, with actual analysis mathematics, you instead feed in data indiscriminately. Internet searches, social media, recipe books, and even other things that aren't related to it. After doing things like counting the frequency of certain words and how many concepts relate to one another, the system builds a kind of statistical model that gauges the likelihood of cats enjoying certain foods. Of course, the algorithms, these are the multi-input mathematics, the underpinning of the machine learning. It's been around for a long, long time. And I would say that the designers sort of bias the system by writing in different weightings, different worthiness for the inputs to the algorithms. But if we let the machine write its own, then it becomes intelligent. And that can get pretty scary. I want to go more into depth in this in the next week's X Squared Radio. I appreciate you being here with me tonight. Remember to look for the good in others and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is Brooks Agnew saying, peace, Earth Explorers.